Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Experience. I am your host, Jeremy Vaney, and this week I have finally got my broadcast partner, Jeff Ritzman, to come on the show solo. He and I host Paratopia Oculus, which can be found at paratopiaoculus.com and also paratopia.net. In a former life, he was a photo video analyst for AboveTopSecret.com. He's hosted lots of things. He's done lots of things. He's been one of those people in this field, much like George Hansen, much like Ted Phillips, both of whom we talk about in this episode a little bit. He's one of those people whose name you might have heard, but maybe you didn't know about him, and that's because he's actually really good at what he does. And that seems to be the problem in these studies, is that the people who are really good don't get the coverage that the schlockmeisters get because they don't generally seek it. But he's seeking it now a little bit because he has a project that I think we're all going to be interested in. And during the episode, we talk about it in terms of a Kickstarter project, but that was because he thought he was going to use Kickstarter. He actually used GoFundMe. So I want to say that right up front. When you hear Kickstarter, think GoFundMe, because that is where it is. GoFundMe.com is the project. And before we get into the episode, and we will talk about it quite a bit at the end, Jeff, hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Sure. And what is the project? I'm excited about this.
Well, the general gist of the idea here is that we're going to try to fund getting some surveillance in the house that I live in currently, that I've been here well about 8 years. And as of late, we've had some weirdness going on in the house, which is not unusual for the house, but it's unusual for right now, or as unusual as it can be. But I've had a lifelong association with this stuff, and it just seems to be ebbing and flowing, and right now it's, I don't know, flowing. So we're going to try to get some surveillance cameras going in here, and possibly some other things should we get enough funding. And this is all an effort to kind of document what happens in daily life, which will be the kind of a rolling, a rolling tally of what happens in the house day to day, life events, these kinds of things. We'll talk about this in the episode as to why those are important. But then the cameras, what do they catch on days where nothing happens, and what happens on days where something significant in the world happens, or with us, or with this family? What do they catch then? And is there a rise in weird events? And can we get these weird events on some kind of documentable video? The cameras that we're talking about getting are drop cams. They are pretty phenomenal in that they capture audio, video in very smooth streaming fashion. And again, if we get enough funding, it won't just be people watching a live cam from three different places. It will be essentially, again, if we can get the funding, the parent company called Nest will actually record the video and store it so that people can say, I saw something at 1:45 a.m. on Tuesday, and I can kind of go to that spot in the recording and find it. And then we can kind of snip that and hold it and see what else piles up in the interim. But again, the more funding we get, the more we can do. So there's room for, random event generators to be placed in each room to see if we get more results from times where there's no activity to where maybe something happens and we might get more or less. I'm not sure how that works, but it's something to try. It's something different. It's a new way to approach this. So that's kind of the goal roundabout. But if you go to the GoFundMe page, you'll see that there's a YouTube video there that I made in quick fashion, by the way, to kind of explain the theory, explain why I want to do this and where the cameras are going to go.
You also have on that video a couple of the photographs that we will be discussing in this episode. And it dawns right on me, we talk about how amazingly bright those colors are that you took of these anomalous lights in your hallway, for a cell phone to have taken these photos. But now it's like a cell phone shot that is, you know, compressed another time to be put onto YouTube. And it still is a phenomenally bright couple of photographs.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to lose that quality. I find that interesting. But so we will have a link on this page at unknowncountry.com. But if people want to search you in the GoFundMe.com search engine, what would be a good way to find it? What is the title?
The title of it is Project Oculus. So there's an original name, Paranormal Windows, because, you know, I look at this thing sort of in the framework of there's windows of experience, and then there's the literal translation of you get a window into maybe viewing something anomalous that happens at any given time. I mean, again, this is, and I say this essentially in the introduction video on the GoFundMe page. We're not looking for the Holy Grail here. We're not looking for some amazing event to be caught on tape. Although that'd be nice. What we're looking for is a correlation between actions in the house and what the phenomena does or does not do. So this is like, again, like Project Core, this is kind of like a starting point. This is step one. But I think it could be an interesting thing once we get into it and once people start putting what they see or what they don't see. And from there, that's kind of where everything kind of starts off. But the cameras will be running at, you know, at peak hours and a lot of time. And so, you know, again, I think it's I think it might be a new way to look at this thing. And if we get good results, then that certainly means we're on to something and we can keep going with it.
Very good. All right. And like I said, that link will be at unknowncountry.com along with this episode and plastered all over the internet. In fact, this was not planned, but last week I did a solo show where I released the whole episode for subscribers and non-subscribers because I wanted it to spread through the internet because it was the big announcement of the Living Mystery Conference coming up in November. So unplanned, I'm also going to release this entire episode with Jeff so that this spreads like wildfire through the internet. And because, like I said, we talk about it in greater detail at the end. But Jeff, thanks for coming on twice now in one episode. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And after these messages for non-subscribers, we will pick up with Jeff.
Whitley and Ann Strieber's book, Miraculous Journey, is well on its way to becoming a classic. One reader after another has found hope and inspiration in the pages of this deeply moving book, which has over 25 star reviews on Amazon.com. From reader Martin Taylor, a book to savor, like much of the Strieber's work, this is a very moving read, and I find myself smiling as much as holding back tears. From Melissa Latimer, this is a beautiful, hopeful story of the power of love in the face of life-changing health problems. From Raven Dana, this book is moving, instructive, and most of all, a beautiful testament to the power of love. And from Catherine Cook, the authors guide us through their dark night of the soul with beautiful prose and truly inspiring insights that leave the reader feeling hope and joy. Reader after reader has taken Miraculous Journey into their heart, and you will too. Available wherever electronic books are sold for just $4.99.
Now also available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble in hardcover and softcover.
UnknownCountry.com. Daily news you can't get elsewhere. A powerful search engine that can open your mind to a world of wonderful news stories dating back 15 years. An insight section like no other. Whitley Strieber's legendary Dreamland. Jeremy Vaney's thoughtful, provocative The Experience. A weekly newsletter, and all for free. But there's much, much more. A huge audio archive filled with quality programming and information you cannot get elsewhere. A full hour of Dreamland and The Experience every week, all commercial-free. Frequent special interviews, material you will never hear elsewhere. the chance to participate in live chats with Whitley Strieber and join our lively commentary sections throughout the site. Go to Unknown Country and subscribe today from $4.95 a month. Incredible information. A great deal. You need us, and we need you.
Ladies and gentlemen of the experience, without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome the one, the only, Jeff Ritzman. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, anytime, Jeff. We know each other fairly well, and you've certainly talked about your experiences ad nauseum throughout your public life. Is there anything of your experiences that stick out as the thing that is most interesting to you in terms of something that you would want people to know?
Wow. That's the opener? That's what you open with?
That's what I've got. I'm sorry.
Holy shit. All right. Let me ponder that for a moment.
Yeah, because, you know, normally you start with, so Jeff, tell us what your experiences are. And it's like, I realize you've talked about so many of them and there are so many and they're so detailed that we couldn't get to it in an hour. So I'm just wondering if in telling these stories for so long, that sounds bad when I say it that way, but in reliving your events as you have, is there anything that sticks out to you as something that's important to say? And really, the question comes from having just done that Chris Gethard show and realizing that, you know, I've got 5 or 10 minutes to be on this TV show with these people who don't know anything about me or these topics. I realized right away I didn't want to even talk about my own experiences, which is what they wanted to talk about, because I felt like the theories and stuff are actually more pertinent to the conversation than just reliving this happened to me. I guess so. Two questions. Do you feel that way about your experiences? And if not, then what would you say is, you know, the sort of big experience that is important for people to hear?
I think rather than ramble on about experiences like you and I have done so many times on so many different shows, right? I think that it can get stale from telling it so many times. And each time that you tell it, you try to relate it in a way that an audience can understand it, because at times it's very hard to get your head around it. Because as I've said before, to tell this experience with an absolute amount of honesty and openness it makes it very much more difficult for them to get their head around and or believe what you're saying as your experience. I think Jacques Vallée was the one who said, you know, to speak of this with 100% open honesty is to be thought a fool. And I think that's very true. But that kind of leads me into, you know, what is the takeaway for me, or what should be the takeaway for people who've been talking about this for a long time, and have gotten past the point of feeling somehow victimized by it in the beginning, to wanting it to stop, to searching for ways to avoid it, and then coming to terms with realizing there is almost literally nothing that you can do, to then turning and saying, well, and this is really the end result for me, is this has a lot more to do with our behaviors and our lives and the way we live our lives, than I think we had dared to imagine before, in the way that we interact with the phenomena. Where does the phenomena come from? I think it comes from the way that we live, the behaviors that we take part in, you know, creative types and the long hours and the obsessive quest for visualization in art. I'm a visual artist, so that's what I become very focused minded on that. I think all of those things kind of culminate in being aware of more things and then those things reciprocating that. So it's more or less like I've come to this point where it's like a two-way street to me. This is not something that just happens to you. You are an active participant in making it happen, or facilitating a two-way kind of ping pong back and forth.
Well, so when you say that there's nothing you can do, What does that mean? Because there is, you know, you've found ways to block it out.
Yeah, that is the place that you end up coming to. It's like, well, now I realize that you do have control over this. And back in the day when people were saying, I just want this to stop, I think I was one of the first people to say, well, if you want it to stop, all you need to do is stop it. And I began to tell people, I said this before, and I'm not sure what the book was or how my number got included in it, but I had people calling me at all hours of the night saying that they had got my name and number out of a book, regarding, you know, alien experiences, as they called them back then. And I would just begin talking to them saying, you know, what's going on in your life, this, that, and the other. When I would say, you know, you're spending every waking moment obsessing about what you don't want to happen. You don't want these experiences to happen. They terrify you, so on and so forth. You know, I said, my argument to you would be turn your back on it. Deny it to yourself if you can. Occupy yourself with other things. Right now, all you're doing is reading book after book, trying to figure out what's going on with you, reading other accounts, watching programs, you know, subscribing to movies and listening to podcasts about this. Get away from it. Turn your back on it. Find another thing to be interested in. And I think that you'll find that those experiences will wane. And eventually, if you ignore it long enough, if you move on from it, and become engaged in something else, it will dissipate to near nothing.
How many of those people did you keep up with?
Did I keep up with none of them?
I was going to ask how many of them were lying to themselves, I guess we can't know that. But
we can't know that. But I mean, the thing that would happen would be I'd get a call 6 months to 8 months later. It was usually around in that time frame where I would get a call and it would be, hey, it's Bob. Do you remember I called you at like 3 a.m. one morning and blah, blah, blah. And we talked about this, and I would go, yeah, Bob, how you doing? Oh, good. Hey, I just wanted to tell you, I know all the resistance that I gave you on the phone that night about what you were telling me and how I didn't think that was going to work. Well, I'm just calling to say it totally worked. And I don't know how you ever figured that out, but it's like all but stopped. And so, interestingly enough, those phone calls were, you know, your first phone call with these people would be 3 or 4 hours or more. That phone call would last a total of 10 minutes, and that was it. They'd say, okay, I just wanted to let you know, because you could tell these people did not want to keep on the subject. They didn't want to continue talking about even the ceasing of the experience happening. But they all kind of more or less at one point or another, most of them called me back to tell me that approach had worked. I didn't know why it was working. I just knew if you walked away, if you turned your back, this would work. And so that kind of took me down the path of saying, okay, what is our role in this? What's the mechanism for something like this continuing to happen throughout someone's life? I mean, there has to be is there a personality type? Is there actions that you do? And
what's funny about that as you're talking is I realize, in some way these beings or this intelligence has been telling us this all along, whether it be fairy folklore or aliens, where people are told by these beings, look, if there's some resistance to them, if you don't want this, then you're never going to see me again. So you've got to make a choice right now. Mm-hmm. And we see that as an ultimatum, but maybe that's a clue that if you are choosing away from them, they are not to be perceived anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a fair assumption to make. And again, we're even trying to discuss this, knowing that a mass audience has to comprehend what we're trying to get across, is that when we say we or them, that even in of itself is kind of a loaded, kind of a loaded statement to make. it's really hard to describe the kind of mechanism that I'm trying to describe, which is something along the lines of the more you give, the more you get, which is the common motto from Paratopia. The more attention that you pay to it, the more that you tend to obsess of it. I mean, we know that the UFO and the alien subject has kind of a hook and line aspect to it, and that it is increasingly addictive. I think a lot of people get into this even with no experience at all, or maybe just a sighting here or there. They get into it with this aspect that they are going to be the one that solves this. I think everybody who gets into this thinks, I can crack this nut. I can get to the heart of what's going on here. And from there, it's kind of off to the races. It's either benevolent space doctors to invading aliens, to demonic possession, to angelic beings, take your pick. The gambit runs wild with this stuff. So one person can wind up in any of many different rooms of this phenomena. And I used to say, well, certain people are self-deluded and certain people are prone to wish fulfillment, and that they want it to be angels, or they want it to be this, or they want it to be that. And I used to really be dismissive of that. And anymore, I'm a lot less dismissive of it in that I recognize that that is the human response to this phenomena. And as the phenomena responds to your take on it, it presents itself in that way. So I don't necessarily think these people are deluded or lying. I think it boils down to, as they perceive it, or as they believe it to be, this is how it presents. You might say it's a party to the delusion, if that makes any sense.
Well, let's get back to something then. Let's go back to your beginning, which is, yes, you're a creative artist, but if we're going to go chicken egg, this thing reached out to you first when you were a kid.
Right.
So, A, it reached out to you first, but B, you didn't have an image of what it was when it reached out, and it looked an awful lot like, the cover of Communion.
Yes. Yes.
So what do we make of those two things?
I've kind of flipped a coin and said, well, either one part of it is, we're trying to put something that is clearly a non-local thing into some linear time that just doesn't work. In other words, it appeared as it would appear now, it appeared then. There is an archetype that is just part of who we are and what we perceive. And this is the communion alien, or the gray, or whatever you want to call it. It's just one of those forms that it takes. We mentioned folklore and the fairies and the elves and all that. I mean, who's to say that this isn't what was perceived back then as the fairy and the elf? This is exactly what they looked like. I mean, we can't know this for certain, but could it be just a simple archetype that's in the human psyche, that this is a common form that this thing seems to take, or a skin that it skins itself with? But no, I mean, absolutely. There was UFO sightings when I was a much younger person, and starting from probably age 5, I perceived very, very strange things. That could be, but not always relegated to a UFO. In other words, not always was it an alien or a UFO, but sometimes it was, just very strange things like people that shouldn't be in a room, or that might be, and again, put into a ghost category or a poltergeist category. These things seem to flow in and out pretty much seamlessly. And again, something we've talked about a lot is the crossover aspect of all this. So, I think the UFO thing definitely took the front seat for me, at a young age, but as it started out, there was literally nothing weird seen in the sky. There was, some strange shapes seen at nighttime in my vision that didn't make a lot of sense and still don't to me. But
you know, that's interesting, because how many times would you say that you've actually seen something that would classically be called a ship? Because you have talked about things in the air, but they're usually things like mechanical birds that aren't quite right.
Right, and orbs.
Or dots of light that look like stars, you know, these sorts of things.
Yes.
How many things in the air have you seen that you would say, or somebody next to you, if they could see it, would say, well, that's a ship?
I mean, I've had more than a few daylight sightings. I would say, you know, if you could say one thing that you could quote into a craft category, you know, would have been a night sighting that was definitely some kind of manta ray or boomerang shaped thing. It was very low and stopped nearly directly overhead for a matter of seconds. But most of the things I've seen have not been quote unquote flying saucers or anything disc shaped. It's been mainly like metallic spheres, spheres of red with what looks like dents and seams in it. But these things hang motionless in the air, flash and disappear, or flash and show up again. I would have to say probably a couple of things that you could qualify as saying a craft of some kind. But most have been completely atypical from that. And the bird you mentioned, that, you know, again, if you want a prime example of the more you give, the more you get, or the more you hunt for something, the more likely it is that you're going to find that something, especially as it exists in the paranormal category. I began sky watching off my deck when I lived in a condominium years ago. And did I see some strange things? Yes, I did. Fleeting things, but nonetheless very strange. Most times, on most nights, these things seem to be directly overhead. In other words, it wouldn't be somewhere low on the horizon. Most times when I would catch sight of something, it would be directly overhead, which I found to be odd. And one particular night, I saw something very unusual for an extended period of time. It did go across the moon as I watched it. It blocked out parts of the moon. It seemed to be shaped like an ice cream cone, very dark, kind of a glowing back to it. Couldn't tell how high it was. It was dark, but I would say some considerable distance away. From that point, oh my God, I was out every night with binoculars, with a telescope, every night without fail. I'd say about two or three nights after that, I go out onto the deck. It's dark. I don't turn the light on because I don't want to ruin the night vision. And as I go out on the deck, I see right off the guardrail of the deck is a ball. And if your audience can picture it, it's just a ball that's about the size of maybe a softball or a little bit larger, with two straight appendages coming out that look to be like flat bars. And this thing is bobbing up and down, and the wings are moving up and down like, hi, I'm a bird. No, you're not a bird. And I panicked and ran in the house and said, there's something off the deck. I mean, what is this? And again, it's just one of those, you look at that and you go, some people would say, well, that's the advanced culture trying to portray itself as a bird. And you go, well, that's ridiculous, because if this is some advanced culture, then they can certainly do a lot in that. It doesn't match with the rest of the picture here. So what is that? And you slowly realize that these are nods and winks. These are things that you're supposed to ponder. And I believe that they are things that induce pondering and obsessing over details, which then facilitates more. So does that make sense that it kind of throws a hook? And if you take the hook, you ponder it more, you attract more of it. And this is where I believe it's more or less like a two-way street. The more you question, the more you ponder, the more activity that you will get. And it will be not, the child listening for the bump in the dark. It's going to be very in your face, very, to you, unquestionable things that are going to happen. And that just seems to be the way it progresses. And it gets more and more in your face. It gets more and more blatant. And at times, and I'll say this flatly, I've lost a number of friends because at a certain point in my life, there was so much going on that it became impossible for us to have people over to the house for dinner because there would be flashes of light in the house that they would see. And they'd just go, okay, I'm out. I'm out. That's it. I can't take this. You know, people would see little balls of light flashing in the hallway or see someone walk out of the bathroom that wasn't there. And that loses you friends. Friends don't always hang around at times with this kind of anti-structural behavior going on where you're consumed by the subject and you're most of your waking moments are devoted to pondering what could be going on. What is this about?
Are these the types of friends who would be the type of people to say, I really wish I was abducted by aliens. I wish I had that in my life. Or, gosh, I wish I had a haunted house. That would be awesome.
Some of them, yes. And one in particular that was, I don't know. He had a genuine interest, and whenever I spoke to him about experiences, him and his girlfriend, I would always get the feeling that they didn't look at me out of the corner of their eye, because that's easy to do. Because some of these things just strain credulity in every way imaginable. But again, the night of the Hale-Bopp suicides, this man came to my office and said, we need to go see this comet. This is, you know, did you hear about this thing that happened today and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, it's terrible. But let's get a telescope and we'll go up on the hill and we'll have a look around. And that night was the night of the boomerang manta shaped thing over the vehicle and was very low. I'd say a little bit higher maybe than a telephone pole off the ground. Maybe a little bit higher than that, but very blatant. And it just so happened that this friend was the one standing by my vehicle, which was directly under this thing. And he was the first one to see it. And he was a mess. I mean, ever after that, he was a mess. He said, and I'll never forget him saying, he said, I know you've told me a lot of strange things that have happened to you, but I never thought I'd ever see anything. And now that I have, it's all real. He would just babble about this on the way back to my office. He would just say, I can't believe it, but it was right there. I can't deny it. And again, I told him, don't ponder this. Just, you saw it. Okay. It's there. It's real. You know, you get it. Now just move on from it. And he didn't. And he went up there night after night looking. Until he stopped at the house one night and told me that when he pulled into the driveway, the garage door was open, which was very unusual for that to happen. And as he pulled in, a basketball came bouncing out of the dark of the garage at head height, like someone had thrown it. And he said it was some force. And I said, you know, that's your metaphoric. Kind of weird event that happens very late at night alone in the dark. Something comes bouncing at you and it's more or less this thing seems to really like metaphor and like symbolic type things. The answer to that to me would be, you know, you want to play or not? So the invitation's extended, you know. He did not reciprocate that. He went inside, ignored it, and went to bed, which was the right thing to do if he didn't want more. But, I believe this can conceivably happen to everybody if the right questions are asked and the right things are pondered.
We'll get to that in a second. But what do you think the fear is about in terms of, you know, okay, it's a metaphor. Do you want to play? But it's also a creepy scene in a movie.
It is.
We've all seen that in a horror movie where something comes out and then it's like Paranormal Activity 4 or something. What do you make of that? I mean, is there something on the other end that isn't sure that it's scaring, or does it always know that it's scaring, do you think?
I don't. Again, this can go back to, I can look at this in one of two ways. I can look at it in the aspect that the shock of it. I mean, certainly his shock of the night of the sighting was one of just complete dumbfoundness. I don't think it scared him. I think it just set him on edge in the awe department. So on one hand, you can say, yeah, there is a genuine fear to be had there when something displays behavior that is not typical for anything that you would see in the sky. Certain creep factor to that alone. But I think we also got to keep in mind that the notion of that these things can take you away, that these things can interact with you and you may not like what happens. The abduction scenario, I think, is well set in everybody's mind. It's part of our culture at this point. So I think that always comes into play in some way or another. But I think that if you are scared by it initially, I think it responds back with fearful things. I think if you approach it from a state of wonder, I think it responds back in a benign way. I think whatever what you expect it to be is how it will present to you. But I don't think that's a deliberate thing on its part. I think it just thinks that's what you want, or that's what you're looking for.
So then you don't think that this intelligence is really that intelligent?
And I've always thought that it has a very hard time interacting with us. I think it desires to manifest around us, and I think we are part and parcel to that happening. But I think that when it shows up, if we approach it from a place of fear, which a lot of people do, I do, of course, I think it says, okay, well, you like scary? I can be scary. Boogity boogity. And then when you start screaming, it goes, no, that's what you wanted, right? I mean, that's kind of like, it's almost childlike in that kind of way. I think it plays at being naive. I think it might play at being kind of aloof in the way that it approaches you. But I think that there is a specific reason for fear. Some of these things and some of these events literally happen on the periphery of your perception at all. And so in order for you to have memory of it, fear is certainly a good timestamp for the mind to grab a hold to and say, yes, I will remember this. So that may be part of it. It may be part that it doesn't know what we want. It sees fear and responds with fearful things. It sees joy and responds with joyful things. This seems to be at least what I've encountered with people over the past 30 years of this.
Well, what about with you? Has it been that way with you?
Yes. Yes.
When was it ever joyful for you?
There were a couple of times where I tried to say, I'm going to be amazed by this rather than fearful of it, because and this was after a point where our mutual friend Lee Townsend had said, you know, there's really nothing that you're going to do. You think that the wife accompanying you outside to take the garbage out, you think that's going to stop anything? It just makes you feel better. So how do you think that you're ever going to get past this if you don't take a step towards it and say, okay, I'm going to approach it with this way and see what happens? And there were a couple times where I always said, I always kind of voiced the intention that if you stay back away from me, I might be okay. Let me see something from a distance. Let me see something that is palatable to me in that regard. And so, yes, there were sightings that I had where I was completely unafraid, but they were of some considerable distance away. Yet, not mistakable for what they were. Clearly something strange, clearly something odd, but always at a reasonable distance away. And so at that point, I felt like, okay, maybe I can set the parameters. And of course, once you think you know what you can do, that's when it shows you you know nothing at all. That's when it says, no, I can be right here now. So is that what you want? Or it becomes kind of like this argument that you're having where, no, I don't want that right now. This was okay. And I think it almost feels like that it pressures you for more, because in order for you to have more, you have to give more. You have to invest more and become somewhat of a conduit for it. So there's that two-way street that I don't think it's got it doesn't seem to have a great deal of patience. I'll put it to you that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let me approach it from this angle too, which is that we tend to say that the ego self, the brain-born self, the conscious part of us is an illusion, and that's the thing that you need to get past for the real self or the higher self, the unconscious, to come out, to be whole, and all of that. All of that stuff is typically said by the same people who then say, but life is a classroom. We're all learning.
Right.
So my question is, what aspect of you is learning? Is it the shallow illusion that needs to go away or not? Because if that's the part that isn't learning, then is anything, and if these are in some ways, I don't know, teachers, or there's anything that they've got to give to us or share with us, are they ever sharing that with the conscious self? Or is everything that we see and interact with on the conscious level sort of a smoke and mirrors act to placate the illusion part of ourselves? And the real thing is unconscious, and we're never going to know what that is until we, you know, unless maybe we become, you know, we illuminate those unconscious aspects of ourselves.
See, this is where I feel like the Simpsons dog during the conversation.
All right, let me try it this way.
No, I completely understand what you're saying.
We'll be back after this.
OneUnknownCountry.com subscriber says, "The subscriber offering has blossomed into an indispensable tool for my spiritual growth. Unknown Country has revitalized my sense of awe and wonder. I am very happy to participate in this exciting adventure." Listen to what another one has to say.
"I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web."
And think of what you get. Commercial-free access to every Dreamland since 2004. Hundreds of special interviews. The Astonishing Meditations of Whitley Strieber. A small collection of UFO videos, but one that is rock-solid authentic, unlike so much you find elsewhere. Plus, the satisfaction of knowing that you support the best edge science website in the world.
Unknown Country. Genuinely new. Genuinely credible. Like nothing else in the world. Subscribe today. We need you. And you'd be surprised. Once you start, you'll realize you need to be a part of this community too. Click on that subscribe tab today.
Groundbreaking. Powerful, mind-opening. Tarcher Penguin is calling Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained, the most important book on the paranormal since Charles Fort published The Book of the Damned in 1919. Whitley Strieber and his co-author Jeff Kripal, Racer Professor of Religion at Rice University, engage in an astonishing dialogue about Whitley's life and experiences. Whitley describes many new experiences, and Jeff explains their historical significance and mythological meaning. There has never been anything like it in bookstores now.
Welcome back.
For me, I mean, this is how I look at it. There was this narrative that was going on with me when experiences were in high gear at one point in my life, to the point where it almost became unbearable. And then there was a point where it trailed off because I just couldn't take it anymore. And I said, I need to, not only do I need to ignore this, but I need to move away from any semblance of being associated with it at all. And so I got rid of research papers. I got rid of documentation and books and videos and all of that. I threw it in the garbage can. And then, you know, there's a, I don't want to say I missed it, but I became interested in it in a different level, which was looking at it from the aspect of, okay, what ordeal have I gone through and what was the purpose of that ordeal? And what it said to me was that, the facade that it presents, and I'm thinking that that might be the facade that it presents to the conscious self. There began this kind of thought process for me that I would have never approached during the time of all the experiences going on and the and accepting of the facade of what it appeared to be. And everybody knows what it appears to be, right? So I began to ask these questions that didn't seem to have any bearing on what the experience told me, but more along the lines of what I learned about me. It was about what I feared, how I feared, how I didn't like to lose control. And that was the one thing that it always seemed to take, without fail. And then it became, more along the lines of, well, not only, you know, the beginning thought was, why me? Why do I have to have this nonsense? What, you know, then it became more about, what am I doing that is possibly facilitating this? Like it can't be here without me. So I know that. So now what? Now what's the next point of this? And I went through a lot of incarnations of that kind of thinking, till you get to this point that, you start to say things like, you know, there is volumes more to life than we've ever been led to believe. And this transcends the UFO and the alien subject and the ghost subject and all that. This gets to a really, much broader, terms of what does life mean and what does reality mean? How do we fit into it? What are we doing here? you know, what's it mean to die? What's it mean to lose someone? Those kind of questions start to filter up through this. And it's all of a result of that kind of experience. And why would it always bubble up from that? You know, I used to host chats on America Online back in the day. This is always where the UFO subject would start. But at the end of the conversation, some 4 hours later, it would be about what happens when we die. What does God mean? What are we here for? What is reality? These are the questions that would be getting tossed around. And of course, those are broad questions, but I started honing into really specific things like, what am I afraid of? Why is fear a part of this? Fear being a root emotion and all that sort of thing. I think it can take you down paths. I said for years that during that point in my life, I learned nothing about what the phenomena was or represented, but I learned volumes about me. And that could be, and I still hold that could be the point of it all, is that you say teacher, quote unquote teacher for this. It could very well be that. And at that point you wonder, well, okay, is this us teaching ourselves? Is this some manifestation of ourselves? Doing this, I don't have that answer. I don't know what this is. I can only speak to what it's done to me and for me.
On that note,
overall, you know,
on that note of not knowing what this is, I was thinking about this earlier today, just in terms of movies and TV shows, the difference between a great mystery show like Lost. And right. A show that sucks, that is trying to be a great mystery show, is that the suck show mistakes confusion for mystery. And so they'll often have these plots and all of these things going all at once, and it's a confusing mess, but you don't really care what's at the end of that confusing mess. And we always talk about this as mystery, but we actually don't know what's at the end of this confusing mess. So, is it mystery?
Wow. You know,
I saved all of these for you, Jeff. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jer. Is it mystery? Yeah, I think on some level it is. But I think, I mean, at least for me, it seems to be more focused on the mechanical level of things, like how does this happen? Why does it happen? What makes the perfect opportunity? As far as what it is and trying to nail that down, I think it's safe to say for my part in this that it's like way too early to tell anything like that. I think that you and I will live the rest of our lives and go on. And there, I don't believe we'll be that much closer to understanding what this is, what it comes from, what it wants. Is it external? Is it internal? I think it's external. But there's definitely an internal component to it. I think the mystery comes in, you know, from the standpoint of why do people react to it the way that they do? And this has been our thing since the first day we ever met was, you know, can you believe what people believe about this? And how people kind of take it at such face value and accept it that way. And don't see the bigger picture and don't see, you know, these, really complex interactions and symbology and, you know, the anti-structural part, the marginal parts of this, and knowing that the marginal part of this, the thing that negates it, for a lot of people is part of what it is. You know, all things like that seem to hint to me that there is mystery here. but not knowing what it is, I don't know. I think I've put that aside for now. Now I just want to know how does it start? What is my facilitative process in it? And then, what is the best times for it to manifest itself and become real, not only for me, but to become interactive with people around me, which has happened pretty much all my life. You know, I think that's a very potent thing when something that is interacting with you, that seems to be physical when it wants to be, but non-physical when it wants to be. And yet that same non-physical or physical entity can interact with people around you. I mean, we say that and it sounds perfectly plausible, but you don't think about how infinitely complex that is. And how amazing that is. I mean, that is truly jaw-dropping. And so for me, the mystery, the biggest mystery of this, is trying to figure out how people look upon this phenomena in all its guises and assume such a pedestrian thing about it, you know, that it's an extraterrestrial people coming from another place to take a look at us. And, you know, and to me, that's just never made any sense to me. So that's the real mystery to me, is how people can accept that, you know, how pedestrian the alien is presumed to be.
Well, but there is within the phenomenon itself, we've had the experience, we've talked about it probably ad nauseum, most exemplified by when we had Colin Andrews on the show, and the conversation itself gets deep and the air changes in the room, and we're in three different houses in three different states, so it's happening for all of us and things go haywire electronically and all that. But the thing that happens first is you feel it. It's as if you are touching mystery in that mysticism way, you know, that sort of deeper way. I wonder which comes first in that, you know, the chicken or the egg sort of thing. If you're a person who believes the surface level of this, whichever surface you choose to believe, can you access the mystery, that changing air in the room through conversations like that? Or do you have to see past those conversations to get to that depth? I mean, do they believe what they believe because in part the phenomena or the air changing the room, whatever that is, can happen for them, and so they think that they are correct?
Well, first of all, I think conversations like that aren't common for a lot of people. I think that the ability to, I mean, you're not going to have that kind of conversation talking about Roswell as an extraterrestrial crash. That's not the kind of conversation that really facilitates that kind of event happening. What facilitates that happening is, you know, taking those internal questions that you have, and everybody out there listening, you know what questions you have about this that you don't talk about with your friends and people online. And they're questions that you have that only you know. When you begin to externalize those questions, that's when you're having that conversation. And that's when the air will change. That's when you will feel a physical change in the room. And that's when weird stuff then tends to happen. I don't know what that means. I don't know why that is. I just know that it can happen that way. You're talking about a conversation that is soul-bearing, brutally honest, ponderous, and deep. Deep is such a trite word to use in this. It's the questions that you have about all of this that are internal to you and often aren't shared with anybody. But if they are, they're with your closest partners in life. Those things are then made, you know, into a three-way or four-way conversation. Those things are then externalized in that brutal, honest, ponderous way. You know, and these are not often questions like, is it real? You know, are they extraterrestrials? What's an alien mean? Why do they need a craft? I mean, these are not questions that are going to get you there. And I always say, and people always want to ask that question, well, what questions are there that will get you there? And I tell them that's your question. You already know what the questions are that you want to ask. You know, mine were always ideas about this thing that would kind of kick off a conversation where people would feel somewhat freed enough to ponder this. I would say things like, I have a strong feeling that this whole phenomenon has something to do with what happens after we die. Which is an odd thing to say about what I think the majority of people think about this is that it's extraterrestrial. Why would that have any bearing on that? And I think those deep conversations come about because I think internally, as you said, the unconscious us, Jeremy, I think the unconscious us already knows that, that this is not extraterrestrial, that this is infinitely more complex and deep and ponderous than that title of ET portrays it to be. But I also think that it masquerades as that, if that is a part of the plan, I suppose. But it certainly facilitates the bigger questions, and those bigger questions are what brings that kind of thing forward. That bristling air. It's very hard to explain what that air is. You know, that's not an easy thing to describe.
Well, let me ask one pedestrian question because it's just, I don't think I'm, this is one of those things that we've never talked about, I don't think, but I'm certain that you've thought about, which is, really you folks out there who believe that Area 51, Roswell, all this stuff is where the answer lies. And we talk about conspiracies and the government and the military. Ask yourself, the narrative of it has always been that they don't want us to know. That's why they do disinformation. But the disinformation has always, always, always led us to believe that there really are aliens that they are covering up. So, is the disinformation that they are aliens? Because clearly the people doing disinformation decade after decade know the result of what they're doing. And the result is that we believe that there are aliens and they are hiding them from us. Why do they want us to believe that? Do people ask that in ufology?
I don't think they ask it quite that way. But yeah, I think, you know, I think we have talked about this in a roundabout way. When we say that there's a cover-up, I mean, and I don't mean to like alienate your audience when it comes to the ET thing. Like, there is a possibility that that's what it is, but I think it's a really small possibility. And there may be more than one thing going on here, as three-ring circus as that sounds. But at least in my experience with this, especially looking into it from the government cover-up angle, which I don't even tread on anymore. If let's say, for instance, that we're on to something by saying that the more you give, the more you get, or the more you pay attention, the more it is able to manifest. What is a feedback loop of some sort between us and this other? That's not something I think that the powers would want to have happen, because that opens a Pandora's box to God knows what else can happen. So from that standpoint, if they portray it as it's little green men from planet Mars and give us some pedestrian answer, well, that doesn't lead to the deeper questions. That doesn't really lead to any kind of pondering of a deeper subject. That just leads you into this mechanical nuts and bolts, flesh and blood thing, which doesn't, it's kind of a dead end. I believe that's part of, there's a bigger part to why there's a lot of infighting and a lot of arguing and fussing in ufology. But that's one of the kickoffs of that, is everybody kind of arrives at this brick wall, and you've put so much time in at that point that you're just aggravated that you put so much time into this thing, and it's led you to this, and there's nowhere to go forward with that. So it's a dead end. So if they're trying to keep manifestations from happening, the best way to do that is to deny, and put out this fairy tale that you can grab onto that would then facilitate nothing further happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know? I think that's a possible answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. It's I wanted a billion, but you know, it logistically, it seems to kind of fit. Because if there are people who know more about this than we do, and there certainly should be people out there that know more, there's got to be some kind of understanding of at least the mechanism of what happens and how and why it happens. Not a totality of an answer, but at least further along than anybody outside of that group would be. There has to be something more known. And certainly, I mean, Jacques Vallée, when we interviewed him, talking about he and his wife, trying to facilitate a Skinwalker Ranch with some limited success. Now, who would have thought of that, right? I mean, how does that work if it's that? You know, if it's the common official answer or official smokescreen, then why that? Why would that work? I mean, that makes no sense, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a definite possibility there.
All right. Well, we are at the end of our time here, which sucks because I could talk to you for another hour. So please come back on the show so I can bombard you with more questions.
Absolutely. I'm happy to come and confound everybody. I believe me, I know how it sounds. It's hard to encapsulate everything in an hour. To try and make sense of anything substantial in an hour is really tough to do. But
well, if they want to hear us babble more, they can always go on to paratopiaoculus.com or paratopia.net, whichever is easier for you to spell, and find our show together there. Now, I know at some point in this program we're going to be inserting a conversation for a thing you're doing, and you're also writing a book. And these are which of these are these things together in some way? I mean, I know you want to. It's like you write a book, and that's almost like expelling all this stuff. Once you've got it on paper, you never really have to say it again. You can if you choose, but it's like really right. Like when I wrote down my experiences and put it in a book, it's like that's over. It's almost like you're clearing yourself out for something next, but the thing that seems to be next for you is very sort of cautious, almost dare I say scientific approach I would say what keeping it at arm's length and yet still keeping it there so that you can monitor it. Do these two things go hand in hand for you? Is this a conscious culmination of these two things, or did I just trigger a light bulb in your head?
No. I think the book for me is just a way of, I mean, I'm going to be 50 years old next year, and some of this stuff happened when I was five. And despite the fact that they're some of the most powerful memories of my whole life, you know, you write this stuff down or it just starts to go. And I would rather there be some kind of something written down in a chronological way where people can see not only what happened, but for me to detail what else was going on in my life. That's something I don't think you see in a lot of books, is a person can recount their story, but it's mainly the story. I don't think people are going to talk about what was going on in their lives at the moment something like this happened. And then you start to see the pattern, I believe, that we're going to end up talking a lot more about in the future with this subject. And so the thing, you know, is basically, you're right, it's trying to scientifically test the theorem that the more you give, the more you get, the more anti-structural you become, the more things seem to manifest and happen. And I've tried to be, I've done experiments for a month and 2 months at a time where I try to be as anti-structural as possible. And go to bed at ridiculous hours and eat off time and no routine at all. I mean, just ridiculous. And I get little things here and there. But what I found was a couple weeks ago, or about a week and a half ago, is that it's not so much trying to be anti-structural. It's just being anti-structural. It's being, you know, being me. It's just, you know, I if I stop trying to be and consciously thinking of it, things seem to happen. And not just with me, but in particular, things with my wife and my son. The past 2 weeks have been ridiculous for them. And so, and very tangible, audible, visual things. So I'm of the belief that I think if there were security cameras running to a live feed online, I think we may get something. I really do. And so the Kickstarter is going to contain a couple of things that I got during my last experiment with this, which were lights in my hallway that are just weird, beautifully colored lights. And I don't know what that means, but lights in the hallway. So there you are. will I see more than that? You know, I don't know. But that's what I want to. I want to garner enough funds to put the cameras in, to run the live feeds, and also to handle some experiments with random event generators, which, if you're familiar with the Global Consciousness Project, that's something that seems to hold sway in paranormal circles, in particular with people who are in the parapsychological realm of things, who study this stuff as scientifically as it can be. So I think random number event generators may give us something in that direction as well. So we will find out, hopefully.
Do you think that if you were brave enough or dumb enough, however that works out, to try to do these experiments outside, that you could, quote unquote, call them in?
I don't think that a deliberate attempt, and that's just what I was getting at with the intentionally trying to be anti-structural, trying to be as out of routine as possible and to live at this frantic, you know, pace with everything. I don't think that that's what really does it. What really does it is, again, to be that rather than to try to be that. You know, this thing won't accept an act. I mean, that's really the point of it. So I think any attempt to go out and call them in a la Prophet Yahweh, I don't think that's going to work. You know, I think that.
But he's a prophet.
I think this thing. Right. So, you know, I think anything like that, if you're going to do that, that means you're going to consciously think about going outside and doing that. And that right there puts it into a certain amount of structure and a certain amount of control. You're trying to call something in to be scene to be videotaped. Again, this is not something that that works that way. I think this thing deliberately is elusive for that purpose alone. That that I think if it's going to be caught visually in any sort of way or audibly in any sort of way, that it's going to have to be during normal life. It's going to have to be unexpected. I don't think there's an aversion to cameras. I think the aversion is when you're seeking it deliberately to catch it on tape to prove something that puts it into an automatic, you know, sense of structure, which it does not respond to. So this is a whole different, to me, this is an entire different framework of trying to capture the phenomena as it happens. And this is just strictly fly by the seat of your pants and see what happens. And then if it doesn't work in a week or two, we'll try something else. So it's going to be a constantly ongoing thing. Hmm. But I think if you can get enough surveillance on it, I think you may get something. You know, because there's an idea of going out with a camera and setting up and getting all your strobes going and all that sort of nonsense. And that's one thing. And that may be successful at some point, but not anything that you're going to be able to look at and say, yeah, that's definitely the phenomena. That's definitely anomalous. I think having eyes on during the hours where things do happen all the time, it becomes part of the environment. It becomes part of what is every day, somewhat routine. But in routine, when you go out of routine, those things become out of routine as well. So this all gets really confusing and ridiculous. But
no, that makes sense. But really what I think is happening is you're trying to find ways to get a good night's sleep. You know that if you keep the cameras rolling, nothing's going to happen.
Right. That's absolutely true.
People, please fund Jeff Ritzman's good night's sleep. No. Actually, I mean, I hope people listening will kick into your campaign because there, as we know, there are other people in this quote-unquote field who are trying to just kickstart their lives or asking for money with for no reason, really. Just like, give me your money and I will lobby for you. No, I won't.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it's just, please let me live. You actually have a real job that pays real money.
Yeah, I have a full-time job and career. Yes.
Yeah. So you're not scamming people out of money. You really do want this to happen. Do you think that there's now obviously you have a real job and real money, but that doesn't mean that you want to be spending all of that money on this high-tech
stuff. Well, that's the thing.
Stuff. And so you think that the audience participation means for this outside of funding it? Because if you wanted to, maybe you could fund it yourself if you saved up money and all of that. But so there's got to be, I'm thinking, just because I know you, that there's got to be some aspect of giving money to this that benefits the audience or triggers something in this phenomenon, some participatory aspect to it that isn't being said.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, over the course of maybe 8 months to 12 months, I could probably save enough money to do this, you know, all on my own. But, you know, I think I look at it this way. You know, I'm going to be kicking in money as well to this. It's not like I'm just sitting back and collecting funds to spend all the money on this. You know, the bottom line is I need help. I make decent money, but I don't have this kind of money at my disposal to do this with. So the way I'm kind of going to structure this is like we'll have a certain dollar amount, probably like around $10. If they donate $10, I don't want this to be like a one-way thing. I want people in this with me. I want your listeners and whoever donates to watch these cams. A la the Hezdalen Project is going to be sort of that kind of thing, where cameras are running from a certain point to a certain point every night, every day. And for, you know, a $10 donation, let's say, they'll get a password. They'll go to paratopiaoculus.com, and there'll be a spot where they can click that and log in, and these cameras will be running. And so at that point, you know, I'll provide a way to, or if they have a way to capture something that comes up on screen. If it's of some substantial time, you can hit Control Print Screen and save a copy, forward that to us, and then I feel like I want active participants in this, so that it's not just me sitting there looking at an iPad running four cameras. I want people all over monitoring these when I'm sleeping. So there's that aspect of it. And then there's also going to be some other things where we may be able to get people more actively involved with it on their own, to where we network these things in such a way, and this is in the broader sense of the more funds that we can collect, the more we can do. People who also have these experiences, people that we know, Jer, from Paratopia, we can send them a cam to run and, again, include their cam in this setting too. Have them videotape what's going on for them. Leave it up, leave it on, and then it becomes part of your home. It becomes part of the environment. What experiments can we do with antistructural behavior, with living out of routine, with the creative process? What can we do at that point to facilitate some sort of action to happen? And will that happen across different participants in this, or just one of us? I mean, these are things we don't know, but these are avenues of this phenomena that have not, as far as I know, been studied or tried before. And so this is new territory. We got to break something. We got to push something forward here. So that's what I'm going to try and do.
Well, that sounds great. So, but then what do you say to the skeptic who says, well, we've had abductees who have put cameras in their bedrooms and they never get anything, and then they turn the cameras off and that's when things happen.
Right. I mean, the best I can say to that is, you know, these things are going to be on. I mean, for some people that become involved later on, I'm sure they're going to run them all the time. You know, this is not the kind of thing where we want to see people going to the shower, right? I mean, so at some point, the camera's got to go off. Normal life at some point, or day-to-day routine, has to happen in order to keep a job. So yes, there is that aspect that that's the idea that's going to happen. But all of those kinds of attempts at connecting some has normally been a camera on someone's bedroom, or a camera in someone's living room while they're sleeping on the couch or something like that. That's not exactly the route that we're going. We're going for first random event generators placed in certain locations. What area shows the most non-repetitive, non-random events? And we say, okay, we're going to focus on that room, because this room, something different is going on. We don't know what, but we're seeing something with that event generator that is not normal for the rest of the house. Then we surveil that part of the house. Then we spread that surveillance out to different rooms. And those cameras run, I mean, for lack of a better word, 24/7. Some rooms in my house can be surveilled 24/7. Other ones, like, you know, particularly the hallway leading to the bathroom, which is an active area in the house, those are going to be limited. So you're going to have, like, probably from 12 a.m. to probably 7 or 8 a.m. Still a substantial amount of time. We're not talking about just filming someone and sleeping. This is going to be pretty much for around the clock at some points, to more substantive nighttime surveillance all the time, every day, without fail. So I think we have a better chance of something happening in that realm rather than nighttime video of somebody sleeping.
Well, and also, you have gotten things on film, or at least on still mm-hmm. on still frame.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible, but also the difference is, I think in those experiments, those are people who are saying, you know, what is going on? I don't know. And they, but you've sort of got at least a handle on a theory. And so you're testing a theory.
Yeah, more or less.
So you're going to be trying to invoke this, trying to, the more you give, the more you get it into existence, mm-hmm. right? While it's, while the cameras are rolling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, for my, for my part in this, I mean, our lives are pretty much as anti-structural as they can get at this point. Between me, my wife, and my son, I think we're all kind of in a transition period with that. We've also got a close family member who was diagnosed with a terminal cancer, and so we're dealing with that on some emotional stressful level. And there's a lot of out of routine elements that are coming from that at this point in time. So we're really in an interesting phase here of life, and in the past week and a half, this has culminated with some pretty strange things. Like, for instance, my wife Lisa coming to me. I was asleep on the couch. It was about 2 a.m. She had gone to the bathroom, came out, pale as a ghost, and she said, "Were you just knocking on the bathroom door?" And I said, "No, I was asleep until you just woke me up." And she said, "Somebody was clearly knocking on the bathroom door. Like, I saw the door move. It was loud." And I was like, "Well, it wasn't me. And our son was asleep. I could hear him snoring upstairs." A day later, my son comes down in a panic. Again, pale, clearly shaken. And he said, "Were you just upstairs?" And I said, "No. What's going on?" And he said, "I just saw a very dark shadow move across the back wall of my room, and the door was shut, and there was nobody there." So you know, we're having things like that happen, and I'm convinced that something like that can most likely be captured on one of these cameras if they're running, if they are, again, part of the environment. And you mentioned the still frame things that we've caught in the hallway. Those things were only caught by me not looking through the camera, if that makes any sense. I saw these things only out of my periphery as I passed the hallway. If I looked directly down the hallway, I saw absolutely nothing. But from the periphery, I saw color flashes. I saw flashes of light, and I just thought to myself, well, I'm going to put my camera around the corner, my cell phone around the corner with my hand, not looking, and I'm just going to keep clicking away and clicking away and clicking away. And out of a number of shots, I got two or three interesting light formations in the hallway that are very brilliant colors for a cell phone camera. And clearly something was going on because these are illuminated, colorful lights that throw absolutely no indirect lighting, which is an impossibility for light to do that.
And these are things that researcher Ted Phillips had intimated to you are things that he's found in Marley Woods that they haven't even reported on.
Yeah, I think he was one of the first people that I sent them to. And I said, does this ring to you? And he said, absolutely. This is almost like what we're seeing in Marley Woods, except you're seeing them in a house. And, you know, he said, that's extraordinary. He said, but the idea that it's not throwing forth any kind of light on the walls or on the ceiling or the floor, he said, this is very much what we get at Marley Woods. It's this light without indirect lighting happening, which to me is a really, it's a weird thing to see. And it puts you in that fearful mode because, again, this is something that is completely atypical to the way our nature works. So that immediately, to me, makes it something's out of control here. Something doesn't fit. Something doesn't look right. And I think that immediately invokes kind of an uber weird response, which borders on fear, but there's an awe component to it. And this, to me, is, again, the hook. And if we can find that hook across many users against many surveillance cameras, I think we're in for some really interesting stuff. I really do.
Well, Jeff Hertzman, thank you for presenting some really interesting stuff to us this week.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. I appreciate it.
You like how I became a host just then?
Right. Yeah. I saw that.
That was good.
Brilliant.
Right? I full circled it. But no, seriously, thank you for doing the show. And I completely look forward to this Kickstarter campaign being a success and seeing what you got. I think this will be fantastic.
Absolutely. Me too. Thank you.
And that's all the time we have on this week's The Experience. My thanks again to Jeff Ritzman for coming on the show, talking a little bit about his life, a whole lot about theory, and telling us about his, that's right, GoFundMe campaign. Not Kickstarter, GoFundMe. So get out there to GoFundMe and GoFund him. GoFund us. Maybe he'll send me a camera. Heck, maybe you'll get a camera. Maybe it's like Oprah. Everyone gets a camera. You get a camera. You get a camera. No. Do it. Go fund this because we want great research, right? And here's an opportunity. Here's a notorious experiencer of high strangeness. Notorious in that, we've talked about this stuff for years. He's talked about it for years before we were talking about it together. This stuff follows him. It's in his house. Let's get cameras on it. Let's get a random number generator in there. Let's do something with what we've got. All right, until next week, thank you for listening. And I hope between this and last week's episode, non-subscribers have a real taste of what this show is about and what they're missing by not hitting that subscribe tab. So I think you're going to want to hit that subscribe tab now, eh? And get all of the full episodes of The Experience and Dreamland and so much more. Take care, everybody.